Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, you've heard a lot about the Great Reset. What does that mean, and what does it portend for the future? As the elites gather in Davos every year, they have a plan. And let's talk about what that plan may mean for the economy globally going forward. Joining me on the program is Chris Martinson from Peak Prosperity. Chris, you wrote a recent story on the front of your website. It's called The Great Reset is Causing a Great Recession. So why don't we begin for our listeners that may not know what the Great Reset is about? Let's begin there, and then let's get into the possibility of a recession.
Well, sure, Jim, I'd be happy to, because I think it's important. And the Great Reset is an agenda put out by the Davos crowd, the World Economic Forum, or WEF. And this isn't a conspiracy theory, or if it is, it's a conspiracy theory that has its own website and has books written about it. And, you know, they very public about what they want for the Great Reset. And so it's a very complicated agenda. They want to reset everything, global trade, economies, amount of consumption of things, how we manage the environment, climate change. I mean, there's literally not a single area or facet that isn't envisioned in this big giant agenda. So it's ambitious, let's put it that way. The way I get my arms around it, Jim, is if you look at what they write about or what they say right up front when they say, hey, we think we need a great reset. One of the opening paragraphs you run into is this one, which basically says, hey, by 2050, we're going to need three planets worth of resources. And obviously, we don't have three planets. So the Great Reset is fundamentally, I think, at least on one large thrust about coming to terms with the idea that we have more demand from more humans for more resources than actually exist. And instead of saying it that bluntly, the Great Reset is all about how you nudge people, convince them, otherwise get people to consume less on a per capita basis for Western economies, and maybe even get used to the idea of fewer people if you have to go that far down the path. But that's what it's about. Great Reset is about controlling and otherwise overseeing every aspect of our economic and, of course, political futures.
You know, it's amazing because there's a book by Peter Zion, and Chris, he talks about what is happening with population. We have an aging demographic in China, most especially with their one-child policy, in Europe and elsewhere. And Peter's thesis is that within basically two decades, as globalization ends, it's going to drive up inflation. We're going to have less, not more, because we won't be able to produce in the same way that we did with a globalized, let's say, supply chain. And he's talking about less people on the planet. And especially if you think about, you know, Western countries like the U.S. or Europe are having less children. We're going there almost in a natural state by the very nature of what's occurring with as we deglobalize, as we bring production back. So I'm not sure the Davos crowd has got their thoughts correctly.
Well, there's a lot they don't get correct in this, Jim, because I'm convinced that most of Davos is inhabited by people who had nannies when they were growing up. They never saw the great outdoors. They never actually built a fire outside at a campsite. They went to the best schools. They then got consultancies or JD degrees out of Harvard, and they went into the finest internships and, you know, clerked at law offices and otherwise just never had any experience with real things being made by real people. You just order that stuff up and you yell at the carpenter when he does a bad job. I really think these are very detached people. And the biggest thing, Jim, that they are missing is this understanding of the relationship between the complexity of our economies, what they can do, and the energy that flows through them. I just don't see any awareness around this. They talk, oh, we'll just decarbonize by 2030, they say, as if you could do that without like losing 90% of the population based on how we use energy in our food production. On and on. Jim, I got to tell you, I think they are what Nassim Taleb would call the intellectuals, yet idiots. Very smart. Not that smart.
Yeah, because you take a look at this green agenda. My own state is a good example. We're going through power outs. We've had several this week, Chris. And we are shutting down. We shut down one nuclear power plant. We've got one left, and thank goodness they're going to keep that open. Otherwise, we'd lose another 10% of our energy. But you take the electrical grid right now, which is overtaxed. What happens, Chris, if theoretically they wave a wand, and 10 years from now, you and I are driving electric cars? Where's electricity going to come from to charge when that car's in your garage at night drawing down power to charge the batteries?
Well, we have an aging infrastructure. So one of the things the United States does really fast and easy, obviously, is send $50 billion of hardware to blow up in Ukraine. We're good at that. Less good at making these long-term investments that we really need. You know, we shut down a lot of coal-fired plants, mainly on the basis of the ESG movement, under this other idea, though, that, well, we could just burn natural gas, right? So a lot of natural gas plants fired up. Obviously, there's some issues there. We got a lot of natural gas in this country, but it still takes a long time to figure out how to switch and transition from one energy source to the other. Jim, the stupidest thing I've ever heard is, because you can solve this with a crayon and a napkin in about a minute, is this idea that we're just going to transition to wind and solar. I mean, we're not, right? Because they're great ideas at the fringe, but they'll never be the center of our electricity production story. Not unless we solve something in battery chemistry that has not yet been solved. We can't store these things. They're intermittent. It's really easy to understand. I don't fault the average person for not understanding that, but somebody whose job it is to be in charge of the grid and to think these things through, listen, spend a half a day and work it out. It's not that hard. You have to know what your base load is going to be. I'm a huge fan of nuclear at this stage, and I think most people should be and would be if they really understand what was at stake. Because as soon as you take electricity out, everything stops. I mean, it's like totally non-negotiable part of modern life.
And when you take a look at it, too, the other issue is wind and solar does not work on a good portion of the Earth's landmass. So, you know, I don't think solar works very well in Seattle or Buffalo, New York during the winter.
No, it doesn't work at all. And the other time solar doesn't work is nighttime. I mean, listen, I got solar, don't get me wrong, but it's a niche. It fills a side role. It's not the central role.
Yeah. I mean, I live in California. It's sunny most of the time. My house is solar powered, but you know, I'm tied to the grid, and we're just having so many of these power outs that I'm going to end up having to get batteries, because what good is my solar if I'm tied to the grid and we go through a power out, which we do frequently in California, because we just don't have the base load or the capacity to carry on. And, you know, you think about the world that we live in now, Chris. We have iPhones, we have iPads, we have iWatches, so all the electronic devices and gizmos. I mean, every single night when I go to bed, I got to go into my library. I got to make sure my laptop's charged. I got to make sure, you know, all these devices that I use today that's become part of our life, like your smartphone, your smartwatch, all these kind of things are charging. Imagine what it's going to be like if all of a sudden we switch to electric cars and they're in the garage at night charging.
It's a huge, huge demand on the grid at this point in time. And so there's a number of things where if you just do what you did, Jim, and you just start adding it up and you ask the question, all right, how many kilowatt hours would we need if everybody plugged their car in tonight? You know, and California, you know, has a very aggressive plan for cutting off the idea that you won't be able to even buy an internal combustion engine after a certain date. What is it, 2035 or something? Anyway, it's
2035, no diesel trucks after 2030. And Chris, you can't use gas lawnmowers and gas weed whackers anymore either.
Or off-road bikes or things like that. I mean, just it's, oh my God. So let's just calculate how many kilowatt hours you need if you need to power up all of that. That's all electric now. It's all the weed whackers, blowers, lawnmowers, cars, trucks. It's a huge amount of electrical power, and obviously we're really ridiculously short of the generation on that. And by the way, you know this better than anybody, and your listeners do, I'm sure, but the Southwest is, for whatever reason, is under a 1,200-year drought that looks like maybe it's part of a longer legacy cycle that we're just now re-experiencing. Hydropower. I mean, if we're only 135 feet away from Deadpool in Lake Mead, which would mean no more electrical generation, no more water flowing out of that thing. It's like a huge, giant issue. And so the idea, you sort of stare at that and you say, you know, I think our plan is let's just get rid of all this all this energy infrastructure that works, and we'll replace it with something that we haven't demonstrated could work. If they wanted to be smart about it, listen, not smarter, take a town, take a small town in California and just say, we're going to test what it means to actually go 100% electric, and we're going to show you it's possible. It hasn't been done. It's just literally, it's cartoonishly unsophisticated at this point. Our leaders are not serious people. They can't even perform basic calculations anymore. I've really lost hope that we're going to get out of this without some trouble.
Yeah, and let's talk about the big elephant in the room. It came out this weekend. Macron told President Biden on a hot mic, hey, they can only produce about another 150,000 barrels of oil. And the big thing that is staring down us, Chris, is peak oil. Saudi Arabia just doesn't have the capacity. In fact, one of the hot stories on the day you and I are doing this interview is they simply don't have, OPEC has been falling short of its production. They simply don't have the capacity. And that's what Macron was trying to tell Biden. Hey, you're going to go there and ask him to produce several million barrels more oil to bring down the price. They don't have it.
No, that was so shocking. So to rewind a little bit, even more shocking than that to me earlier, I think it was March, Biden picks up the phone, says, hey, he wants to talk to Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. He wants to talk to the president of the United Arab Emirates. And guess what? They didn't take his calls, right? So, wow, they didn't take the United States calls, but they did take calls from President Xi of China and Putin from Russia, but they weren't taking our calls. And so that Macron was the one delivering this. I guess Macron has a better relationship over there. But for him to say that in public, hot mic, and he's too smart to have done this, you know, accidentally, he wanted the world to know that the UAE is flat out, they're supposed to be a swing producer. We thought they had surplus capacity. They don't, according to this statement he made. And Saudi Arabia, only 150,000 barrels per day more, way below their putative alleged 13.5 million barrel per day production cap. It's probably going to be closer to about 10.5 million barrels per day. That's huge. We had China in 2017 announced they're at peak oil. That actually hit in 2018 as they predicted. They're importing the gap. And we had Russia come out just a number of months ago and say they're at peak oil. So that's it. I mean, we are like down to the last part of this story. Everything you and I have been talking about, peak oil. Wow, wouldn't have been smart if the world said, yeah, that's a real thing. It's not even a theory. It's just a description of geological events. Fine. What are we going to do about it? We've done nothing, and still to this day in this country, the United States, Jim, people are debating and refuting that, and the Department of Energy won't even say the words. It's just, again, unserious about a very serious situation. That's what our leadership is.
Well, you know, and we're doing this at the time that we're shutting down production here, making it more difficult to produce. At the same time, we push forward this green agenda. I'm just reading from oil price. One of the key stories this week, oil markets could face a doomsday scenario this week in finding out that OPEC does not have the spare capacity. So what Macron was saying, and I think what the president is going to find out, they don't have the oil. And I want to talk about something that most people don't realize, Chris, and that's most of our oil comes from 25 giant oil fields like Garwar in Saudi Arabia that accounts for half of their production. These oil fields were discovered 50 to 70 years ago. And we saw, for example, in Mexico with the Canarel oil field, the second largest in the world, that thing is basically over with. And we're not discovering these giants. So there's a word called depletion, and nobody seems to take notice of it. And you don't see the EIA or the IEA really talk about this. They keep talking about, we got to go green, we got to go green and make these investments. Chris, I don't know what we're going to do about oil, because almost 20% of the use of oil goes into petrochemicals. Everything from roofing to aspirin to carpet, all the stuff that we use in our homes on a daily basis comes from oil.
It does, and there's no replacement feedstock for that. We're not going to do that by other means. And obviously, electricity doesn't help you in that story. So anything you might get from solar or wind or hydro doesn't help. we really, really need oil. It is the lifeblood of our economy for those petrochemicals you mentioned, but also for heavy transport, right? Nobody's going to be running a container ship on batteries anytime soon, or a jumbo jet's not running on batteries anytime soon, if ever. So all the things that we need for our global just-in-time economy, you know, where, you know, chips are manufactured in Taiwan for motherboards put together in, you know, China that end up becoming a HP that's manufactured somewhere in Texas, right? Computer, right? These long supply chains require shipping, air shipping, ocean shipping. All of that's 100% oil at this point in time, give or take, you know, a couple percent. And so the idea that, you know, what we're just going to like do this by other means, again, is a fantasy. And it's not really well supported. So this idea that oil is now no longer, we don't have a swing producer in OPEC. They're out. They have no more capacity. But Jim, this is also true in the U.S. shale space, where remember, we had these explosive growths in shale oil output. Beautiful stuff. Amazing technology. Awesome. Right down there in the Bakken in North Dakota and the Permian Basin and all that. Well, that's over now. Because where before those companies were incentivized for production, the CEOs would get big bonuses based on production gains. Well, that burned a lot of cash, it turned out, at the end of the day. And so now they're incentivized for cash flow. Guess what? We can plot the end of the drillable acres that are known about in all these major fields. And the companies have wisely said, listen, we can either ramp production up like we did for about 3 more years and then it's done, or we can keep our companies running for another 10 or 20 years with a responsible drill program. We kind of hold production flat and just, you know, milk those assets for as long as possible. That's the best fiduciary response for shareholders. I'm glad to see them doing that. But it means people have to get their minds around this whole thing that was marketed to us, that we're Saudi America and we can just expand shale production whenever we want. We're the swing producer. Nobody in the shale space is doing that anymore, and they're doing it for good reasons that make sense from a resource base, from a financial sense. But the sooner we get our minds around the idea that, yeah, we got a ton of stuff there, it's good, but it's not going to grow like it did 2005 through 2015. That was a once in a fun time, you know, bonanza. It's over. So people haven't wrapped their minds around that. Jim, I got to tell you, for your listeners, the thing that's catching me is the gap between the paper market for oil and the physical market. I've never seen it wider. Same thing we might see in like the silver market. Who is dumping all this paper and why is the physical market so tight? I thought we were going to see that blow up on COMEX and silver first. I think we're going to see it in the oil markets. I've never seen anything like this. Somebody selling paper, but the physical people can't find the barrels. So those are trading as much as $5 higher. Never seen anything like this before.
No, and you take a look at, we watch oil inventories. I've never seen oil inventories this low. And then you and I know, Chris, oil prices are determined at the margin, and it's really what those inventory levels are. And you take a look at it, and you know the Fed is raising interest rates. First of all, the Fed cannot create barrels of oil. The only thing the Fed can do is destroy demand by throwing the economy into a recession, which gets back to your piece, the reset is recession. So let's go there, because the Fed is raising interest rates. The only thing it can do is cut back on demand.
Well, it's true. And of course, you know, there's a lot of things way outside of the Fed control. The Fed could raise rates, lower rates, QE some more, print another $10 trillion. It won't matter to the oil markets at this stage. It won't matter to the food markets either. These are just physical markets that have some pretty dire situations going on for a bunch of complex reasons. So the Fed is a little bit out of the driver's seat right now. So I think a little of that luster, that aura that the Fed is the oracle, they're omnipotent, they control all, that's now out of their hands. And as that story works its way through, that the Fed has kind of lost control, the ECB has lost control, that they no longer can control things, that's where I think we could see very quick changes in market responses. And that's why this whole idea of a great reset, which I know these people have been pushing for, and they misused COVID as an emergency to ram through some of their most favored things. They wanted to control us. That's how the great reset's really about the great control. They loved the idea of COVID because they could push through this idea of vaccine passports. And if we could just control what people do there, you know, they're going to come up with a central bank digital currency because now we can control what people consume. That's really the substance of it. My view is, hey, best of luck to them and all of that, but it's not going to work because these are complex markets. Humans are complex creatures. Cultures are complex. Markets are complex. And what do we know about complex systems? Not much. You have to, you put new pressures on them, and all you can do is observe them for what we call emergent behaviors. You can't predict what's going to happen. Well, the Great Reset is all about controlling and predicting something that's inherently uncontrollable and unpredictable. That's the big gap. And, you know, there's like a, their ideology is just, is broken. We over here in the real world understand that energy is the master resource. Oil is the king of that. If you have energy, you can have all sorts of other things. If you don't have energy, you can't have any of those other things. That's it. And somehow the Great Reset crowd, the Biden administration, just unbelievably ignorant about this very basic concept.
In 2020, when we shut things down, oil demand plummeted and stories were coming out. That's it for demand for energy. We're going to move to this green economy. And then all of a sudden, when the lockdown stopped and the economy started coming back, demand really spiked up. And we're seeing prices now that we have not seen in this country in terms of gasoline. I mean, there are parts of California, Chris, that you're paying over $7, $8 for diesel fuel if you can get it. And people don't realize that this world functions on energy. And we're seeing prices that could go as high as $150, if not more. So, you know, I always said, you know, basically that, you know, oil is really like the Fed funds rate. If you take a look at every recession, go back to 2008 when the price of oil got to $150, go back to 2000 when the price went from $10 to almost $40 a barrel. Higher oil prices, what would you tell consumers about the prices where they are now? Because this may be or pretend what the future looks like when it comes to energy.
Well, Jim, I quote you all the time on that. The oil is the new Fed's fund rate. It is. And by the way, at $7 a gallon, you are already paying the same price you would pay as if oil was $250 a barrel. So people don't realize this. They say, oh, Chris, do you really think oil could go to $200 a barrel? I'm like, of course, you're already paying that rate. What's happened now is the price of oil has gotten disconnected from the pump price because of this refining bottleneck. And we have bottlenecks in all sorts of industries. This is just one of many that's like now hitting us. That's what we're paying. And so of course oil could go to $250 a barrel easily. We're already paying it. Europe already pays as if it's $400 a barrel. Would people pay that much? Of course they would. They already do. So the idea that oil, you know, we got to get rid of that anchor to the reference price of the past. Those days are gone, I believe, at this stage. And it's a larger, more complicated discussion I know you know about, which is that, hey, we had about a 6-year hole where the globe did not invest in upstream oil and gas CapEx. Didn't happen. It's like $2 trillion of missing investment. You can't make that up even if you throw $2 trillion at it. It won't happen. So we're going to be facing shortfalls, I'm predicting, at a minimum for the next 4 or 5 years. And that's if and only if we don't suddenly discover that the Ghawar field was a mirage. And I think there's good reason to suspect that because I know they brought in a bunch of slant drillers about 6-7 years ago. And so what they're doing, you imagine squeezing that giant field from below with all this water flooding they're doing, and you're pushing that oil towards the top. Well, the last thing you do is you put in what are called creaming wells, where you're sucking the cream off the top, you slant drill in, and you just go right, you put a long horizontal bore right across the top of the reservoir, which is your last final act, because you're trying to get pure oil as possible coming into a long, flat, horizontal well rather than all these vertical wells, which are slowly watering out or rapidly watering out. Those creaming wells are amazing. They allow you to get that last good oil, but they water out like that because of how they're flat, and then the water hits them and they're done. So I honestly think we're in for some real shocks coming up. And I think most people are really unprepared, Jim, in a lot of dimensions for what this really means.
Well, it's not just that. It's also food production, because a lot of food is grown with fertilizer that's made from natural gas. So look at natural gas prices for Europe and look what they are here. And Chris, we're looking at high natural gas prices here when normally around this time of the year, they're usually lower and they don't rise until you get into the winter months. You know, I hate to see what winter's going to look like here in the U.S. God knows what it's going to look like in Europe.
Well, Europe is just so over the barrel on this one, pun intended, I guess. It's really bad. I don't know how to really interpret what's happening. You know, obviously, the United States worked hard to block Nord Stream 2, which was the second pipeline coming out of Russia towards Germany. We blocked that. That didn't happen. It's built, but it hasn't been permitted, so no gas is flowing there. So Nord Stream 1, it has three big compressor stations. Russia's story is, hey, we didn't get a compressor back that was supposed to be reconditioned. Siemens was working on it in Canada, but sanctions, and it couldn't get shipped. That part is true. I don't know how true the next part is. They said, and therefore, we have to shut that compressor station down, which meant that they had to drop the gas coming through by about 60%, 40% off of that main pipeline, but it translated into a 60% drop at the end of that pipeline. Who's there? Germany. Massive, massive decline. So Germany has a three-stage alert emergency system for energy. They're at stage two. You know what happens? Stage three, they pick winners and losers. Their plans call for companies to shut down because they're going to preserve or triage the remaining gas for residences. I guess they don't want their people to be freezing. So they're going to shut businesses down. But what does that mean? Nobody knows. I mean, you know, listen, Germany makes a lot of very important component parts for all sorts of things. And if they have to start shutting down their manufacturing, we're going to see economic collapse. And I use that term carefully. And a collapse to me is a very rapid reduction in the output of a sector of the economy. And so I would predict that we would see very, very sharp shocks to all sorts of different industrial components. But again, we're going to have to wait and see what emerges from that, because even within that, there'll be some triaging, and you can't predict what that's going to look like until it happens. So that's what's happening there. Same thing here. We have a lot of natural gas, but we're actively seeking to export more and more and more of that to help support Europe in the form of liquefied natural gas. Right now, we have more than usual because the Freeport terminal for LNG in Texas blew up and is not going to be repaired to the end of this year. So that temporarily gives us a little bit more natural gas here. But again, as soon as that comes online, I think we're going to see the United States exporting, which is going to cost U.S. citizens a lot more. We probably ought to be having a conversation like, do we really want to take our natural gas and liquefy it and export it? Or would we rather be using that here for our own purposes? I would be in that camp personally.
The other thing I think you need to start preparing, you're already seeing it right now because of supply chain issues and energy issues, is some of the shelves on stores. I'm noticing it in Costco. I'm noticing it in grocery stores where you'll go down an aisle and you'll see certain sections that are blank. There's nothing there. There's supply shortages, and that's food production. I mean, we haven't even talked about that. But we should, because I know I'm preparing to grow my own food.
Well, good. I am so glad to hear that. And I advise everybody do that. And not least of which is, you know, to harken back to Lake Mead really falling. I predict at some point in the next year or two, we're going to have another hard conversation with ourselves as a country and say, gosh, 50% of that water is being used for agriculture, which is being used to grow crops in the deserts. We're probably going to stop that. That means a lot of fruits and vegetables are probably not going to get produced over the next couple of years, unless water happens to fall out of the sky into that basin. But if that doesn't happen, like it really hasn't for the past 20 years, we're going to have to get used to the idea of less fresh fruits and vegetables being available to us, which means we should grow our own as much as possible. So I agree with that. And I also think that we're going to have to start beyond fruits and vegetables. We may have to start thinking about growing more of the baseload calories, which I'm a big fan of growing things like potatoes. I do grow some grains here a little bit, corn, things like that. So more and more people are getting on with that. If you can't do that, find your local farmer and bright, young, shiny kids, support them, because demand always precedes supply. So if you want more local farming supply, demand it. Go out and buy it, pay for it, support these people. They're doing great work. But I do think we're going to have to consider relocalizing our agriculture big time.
You know, that's amazing, because during World War II, you heard about victory gardens. Americans were used to having gardens where they grew tomatoes, zucchini, things like that. It's amazing that we may end up going back in that direction. So as we conclude here, Chris, with your article, the Great Reset is probably going to lead to recession. We see a recession if we're not already in one. The combination of rising interest rates and rising oil prices, rising inflation, the combination of all three of those, at least in our view, assures us we're heading into a recession.
Well, absolutely. And the financial conditions, which would be a sum of all things like how hard is it to get a mortgage versus getting a corporate loan. Financial conditions right now, Jim, are as tight as they've been since right before the 2008 onset of that great financial crisis. So I actually think a recession may be underselling this a little bit. Recessions are kind of uncomfortable and, you know, things are slow for a while. This could be worse than that because of all the money printing, all the accumulated debt, plus all these other factors that you and I have been talking about. I think people really have to brace for impact on this one. I hate to put it that way, but this is a lot of bad decisions all kind of coming home to roost all at once.
And the other thing, and this goes back to things that you've written about, I've written about in Peter Zeihan's new book, is the last 70 years with outsourcing manufacturing, where, you know, you could have raw materials come from, let's say, South America, shipped to Singapore, then shipped and assembled in China, put on a boat and shipped to Los Angeles. That world is coming to an end. So in the future, the Davos crowd may get something done without anything, and that is we are going to have less, not more, just simply because of deglobalization and energy.
Well, I do, and unfortunately, I have a darker conclusion too, which is that if this is being done ignorantly to ourselves, shame on us, but what's about to happen is we are sacrificing our own standards of living for those of China. And China comes out the big winner. I don't know, you know, the darker side is China actually pulling some strings that we need to talk about? Because in this story, the Western world, which, you know, the Great Reset, really, honestly, they want to reset Europe and the United States, a little bit of Canada, Australia, New Zealand. They're just sort of along for the ride. Jim, I got to tell you, it really looks like what we're doing to ourselves at the worst moment of history, where I believe fully that the next 10, 20 years belongs to those who have access to the resources. It's a resource story, pure and simple. China's doing that. They're doing a great job at that. Golf claps for them. I think their strategy makes sense. Ours doesn't make a lot of sense. And if we're intentionally taking ourselves down a few pegs, maybe we should have that conversation out in public directly and we could vote on it and maybe make a decision. But it's being done to us. That's what people need to be aware of. Our leaders are actively destroying our economies and our standards of living. Ignorantly or intentionally, you decide. Doesn't matter. The conclusion and the result is the same.
Couldn't agree more. Well, Chris, as we close, why don't you give out your website? Your article was just fabulous with the video that you did about the reset leading to recession.
Well, sure. Thanks. Peakprosperity.com is the website. And we have a variety of free information there, but it's really subscribers who I save my best work for. So we got a great crew of people, many thousands of people. We're all chewing over what's the data. But more importantly, what do we do about it? Because information without action is just annoying. So we're all about getting as much information as possible. I'm the information scout for my tribe. Happy to do that. Great crew of people. And I couldn't do it without their support. So thanks for the opportunity to mention that. But it's just a phenomenal crew of people we got.
And also, Chris, talk about, if we could, as you close, your crash course. One of the best things I've ever seen.
Oh, thanks. The Crash Course is a video series. It's also a book, but the video series comes in a series of chapters, and it covers the economy in a bunch of chapters. People need to know, Jim, how the money system works. If you don't understand how the system works, you're lost in this environment, I believe. So covers that, the economy, and then it covers energy in the ways we've been discussing, but it connects it back to the economy. And then the environment, which is for me a really resource story as well. And I connect all of those, and it provides a systems level view of where we are and where we're going.
Well, it's a pleasure speaking with you again. Come back and visit us again.
Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure speaking with you too.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.